Support for podcasts of Medical Monday comes from the hospitals of HealthQuest and HealthQuest Medical Practice, physicians offering primary and specialty health care in private office settings throughout the Hudson Valley. 1-888-525-HQMP or 4767 for appointments.
Good afternoon, everybody. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to the Vox Pop for this Monday, November 7th. I'm Alan Chartok. Support for Medical Monday comes from Saratoga Hospital. Saratoga Hospital and the Saratoga Hospital Medical Group are multi-specialty group practice offering patients a range of comprehensive medical, surgical, and behavioral services. SaratogaHospital.org. Joining us this afternoon for Medical Monday is Dr. David Schaefer. And are we lucky? Of New York Oncology Hematology, the Capital Region's largest provider of cancer care. He's here to answer your questions about prostate, bladder, and renal cancers and related topics. 1-800-348-2551. Hello once again and welcome back to the Vox Pop on WAMC. Pardon me, a live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Alan Chartok. Joining us on this Medical Monday to discuss prostate, bladder, and renal cancers is Dr. David Schaefer of New York Oncology Hematology, where he is the principal investigator for all research trials involving those types of cancers. Dr. Schaefer is also a clinical assistant professor at Albany Medical College. He's board-certified medical oncologist. Dr. Schaefer received his medical degree and doctorate from the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Dr. Schaefer, welcome to Medical Monday.
Thank you, Alan.
The number to call, ladies and gentlemen, is 1-800-348-2551. It's going to be a very busy show, folks. 1-800-348-2551. Get in now. We'll try to get your call in as soon as possible. We always have been getting left with lots of people still on the line. So if you want to ask a question, now's the time to do it. You can also post comments on our Facebook page, facebook.com/WMC Radio. You can tweet your questions and comments at WAMC Vox Pop, and you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Well, Dr. David Schaefer, I guess the first question is, do an awful lot of people have renal cancer?
Well, it's fairly rare cancer. I think it's about, about 40,000, something like that, per year. The main etiology in this country has been cigarette smoking.
And we think that's what causes it?
Yeah, we think generally that's what causes. It's usually in the fifth and sixth decade, something like that.
Huh. So between 50 and 60.
Yeah, 60s, I think, is maybe the when it really starts, and then and 70s and 80s, et cetera. Yeah.
Wow. And bladder cancer?
Bladder cancer is also in the same general age period. As medical oncologists, we see the more advanced stages of bladder cancer. The urologists often do the first diagnosis. Somebody comes in with bleeding in the urine, and often those patients have superficial bladder cancers. The superficial bladder cancers are treated entirely by the urologist. They may scrape off the superficial bladder cancer, then may give some treatments directly into the bladder called intravesical BCG. And sometimes those patients never progress to invasive bladder cancer that could spread and that would get the medical oncologist like myself involved.
Now, you've been around for a little while, and you see this stuff. So when I tell you that somebody is a smoker, and you see them as a patient, how do you stand it when you know that's preventable?
Well, you know, a lot of times patients I see, it depends on where they are in their disease. We certainly encourage smoking cessation when we can. It's a stressful time for some of the patients who have really advanced cancer, and, you know, we try to support them as best we can. But, yeah, it's frustrating because there's so many preventable diseases that I see that are caused by cigarette smoking.
Okay, David Schaefer, we'll start taking some calls.
Okay.
We'll go to Jim in Matamoros. Jim, you're on. Go ahead.
A change from what I told Joe. How common is transitional cell carcinoma of the bladder?
It's relatively uncommon, but it's in smokers, it's more common for sure. I think it's a threefold increased risk, I believe, for smokers compared to non-smokers. It's I think it's one of the, I think it's the seventh leading, if I remember correctly, cause of cancer in America.
His voice broke up. What's the name of it again?
Transitional cell, also called urothelial cancer of bladder. That's the typical type we see in the United States. In other countries, like in Egypt, the other common cause would be squamous cancer of the bladder, and that's caused by schistosomes.
What's the schistosome? What's
schistosome's a parasite.
Okay, great.
So it's rarely seen as a cause of cancer in America. But in America, it's mostly cigarette smoking.
Okay, thank you, Jim. All right, now we'll go to Al in Niskayuna. Al in Niskayuna, you're on. Hello, Al. Hello, Al, you should be.
Good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call.
Okay, I just want to mention to everybody out there, don't listen on the radio. Once you call, you got to listen through the phone because there's a seven-second delay. Go ahead.
Okay. My question is, I'm a 58-year-old male, and my question is trying to figure out if I have something wrong with my prostate, and I'll tell you why I asked that question. I have, during intimacy, low volume, and I'm wondering if that can be a sign of a prostate problem.
It could be. Have you seen a urologist?
I have not.
Okay. The prostate does contribute to the volume of the ejaculate, so sometimes that can be a cause. It may not be a cancer-type cause. It may be a benign cause, but it's something I would follow up with the urologist about.
So, wait a second. When you use the word ejaculate, we're not talking about urination now. We're talking about ejaculation.
I think that's what you're talking about, right?
Correct. Yeah. That's correct.
Okay, great. So do what he says. Go see your urologist.
Okay, and is it normal for that to decrease during, you know, middle age and as I approach 60?
Well, I think 60 doesn't seem too old to me, I don't think it. I think it's a little bit abnormal at that age for it to decrease. I would have it checked out by a urologist for sure. It's a simple thing. I think it would probably bring you some reassurance.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. Donna emails us and says, any recent advances in pancreatic cancer?
There have been some recent advances in pancreas cancer. I'm not the specialist that sees that here at our Albany Medical Center. But yes, there have been some advances. There have been certainly for patients with advanced pancreas cancer, there's new chemotherapy regimens, triple combination regimens that have much more activity than we've seen before. There's some new kind of experimental combinations of therapies, old chemotherapy drugs that are packaged, but it's mostly still chemotherapy with pancreas cancer.
Okay. Let's go to Charles in Albany. All right. Charles, you're on.
Doctor, I'd like to know if it's possible to use nitrous oxide to alleviate the excruciating nature of cystoscopy.
Oh, that's a good question. I've never heard of that. I'm not a urologist, and I don't do those sort of procedures. That's another urology question. We work very, very closely in the fields that Alan mentioned. I see broad prostate, bladder, kidney, testis cancers, and we work as a team with the urologists, and they do those procedures, so I'm not really sure about that.
Now, is testis for younger men?
Yeah, testis is usually younger men. Usually there can be a late kind of resurgence of risk of testis cancer, but mostly in the 20s.
Okay. And how, it's a urology question, but how important is a low, score, when you get tested?
For testis cancer?
Yeah, no, for cancers, prostate cancer, for example.
Low PSA score?
Yeah,
okay, you're getting into a whole bag of worms here with PSA testing, but did you want to talk about PSA testing? That's a big one. Okay. So PSA testing is very, very controversial. There have been guidelines. Most of the internal medicine doctors here are told that they shouldn't do PSA testing at all for prostate cancer. And many of us who see prostate cancer disagree with that. We can agree that there are not definitive clinical trials that we like to see that have shown, concordance in terms of survival benefit with PSA testing. But most of us use PSA all the time for following patients with prostate cancer. My personal opinion is that the PSA test is not the problem, but it's how we use the PSA test to justify other treatments for men with prostate cancer. That's where all the additional morbidity comes along, is that we're using the PSA to justify a prostatectomy for a patient who may have maybe in their 70s or late 80s and have no chance of having any problems from the prostate cancer. Or we may use the PSA test to justify additional radiation after they've already had a prostatectomy, or starting a hormone therapy when they may have only a rising PSA but no other cancer. So I think the PSA test is not the problem, in my opinion.
Okay, Timothy, what else you got? Huh. Well, maybe I got that wrong.
I think my answer was too long.
No, it was my fault. Okay, we'll go to Timothy. Timothy, you're on.
Intestinal blockage.
Hey, Timothy, start over again. Go ahead.
Oh, okay. I have Parkinson's, PD. I've been hospitalized once for intestinal blockage. Constipation goes with that. And I don't know, I urinate bright yellow at times, or bright or dull red. And that seems to match up about 24 hours after I have severe back pain. I'm wondering if it's something I should be pursuing, getting tested on. I'm 64 years old. Most prostate cancers, I understand, progress very slowly. It does run in the family, as do cerebral strokes and possibly Parkinson's. So I'm thinking that it's maybe something I can put on my very low on my rather massive physical symptom priority list and maybe ignore it for a while.
Do you have a primary care doctor?
Yes, I do.
I mean, I would, if you're having those symptoms of the red urine or orange urine, I would go see the primary care doctor first, and they can do some testing on the urine to see if there's anything there. The symptoms that you described didn't sound so much like prostate cancer. They could be potentially a bladder kidney cancer, but more likely by far would be something like an infection or stone and something like that, the stone or an infection in the kidneys. There's a lot of
another blockage developing.
There's a lot of blockages that can be from stones and things like that. So I think that you're kind of early. I would see the primary care doctor first, have them mm-hmm. check your urine, and then go from there.
Okay. The other complicating thing is I am quite sedentary at times because of no sense of balance. When I have the carbidopa lipid, I'm 64 years old, so you know I've been taking it for a while, and it's losing some effect on me. So I have a walking machine and I have free weights down in the basement. Would either of those do me any good?
Well, do you have a neurologist who follows you for the Parkinson's?
Yes, I do, right there, Dr. Molo.
Yeah, that's who I would speak to about that.
Okay. We're going to let you go. We got to take a break. Thank you very much for that. And Zachary, take it away.
Support comes from Ichiban Japanese and Chinese Restaurant, Central Avenue, Albany, serving hibachi dinners, sushi, sashimi, curry soups, and Thai entrees. Daily specials, delivery expanding to Gilderland, 518-432-0358. Albany Cardiothoracic Surgeons, providing patient-centered heart surgery for over 40 years in the capital region, practicing cardiac surgery at St. Peter's Hospital, ACTSURG.com. Edgar Bosick, Certified Financial Planner, Private Financial Design, South Hadley. Your life, your plan, your portfolio, privatefinancialdesign.com. Securities through Cambridge Investment Research, member FINRA and SIPC. Stone Soup Concrete, specializing in handcrafted and environmentally sound concrete countertops, sinks, furniture, and floors. Serving the Northeast since 2001. StonesoupConcrete.com and on Facebook. And from the 1850 House Inn and Tavern, featuring enclosed and heated Deck 435. Waterfront dining in the center of the Hudson Valley, where the mountains meet the Catskills. The1850house.com.
And we're back. We're back. And we're delighted to be here with Dr. David Schaefer of New York Oncology Hematology, where he's the principal investigator for all research trials involving prostate, bladder, and renal cancers. Okay. Doctor, we got a note. Could the doctor please discuss any cause-effect relationship between the risk of developing prostate cancer and diet, specifically dairy intake?
Well, there's been a lot of thought about that because there's a lot of differences in geographical distribution of prostate cancer, and some of that may be the fact that PSA testing is done more frequently in Western countries than in Asian countries, but there seem to be a lot fewer prostate cancer patients in Asia. So, you know, one of the things that's been thought about is that the diet may be different. And there's been some studies. They're not the biggest studies in the world, but they've looked at generations of people who've come over from Asia. And so studies showed that the people who'd been here for maybe 20 years, their risk of prostate cancer starts to go up a little bit. And if you look at their children who are genetically 100% Asian, their prostate cancer risk appeared to be similar to the general population in America. So those kind of migration studies have, again, lended some credence to the possibility that diet or other environmental factors may be important. But we really don't know which factors.
Just to be clear,
yeah,
are you saying that there's less milk consumption in Asia than there is here?
Milk, I'm not so sure about. And what's been said before is that red meats and versus soy protein. Red meat as a source of protein versus soy as a source of protein. Now, dairy, I'm not so sure about whether I don't think there's as much dairy in China and in Asia, but I'm not so sure about that.
Okay. Ladies and gentlemen, you have a very good chance to get in here. We have a little lull in calls. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. We will go to Peter in Kingston. Let's see here. Peter, you're on. Go ahead.
Hi. Great. Glad to be on the show. So I am 63. And when I was 21, I had seminoma testicular cancer. I did not do the radiation that was recommended at the time, did an alternative program, was fine. Now I'm at 63. I've had very high PSA numbers for a number of years. I've had two biopsies done, and I currently had another bout of high PSA numbers. And so I said, is there something else we can do? Then cutting me again for a biopsy, I may just be someone with high PSA numbers. So they did an advanced MRI, a full spectrum MRI, and they did see like a 1-inch shadowy area that could be cancer. And so I am just kind of like at 63. I'm someone who's much more into alternatives than going and getting sliced up or having, but the urologist is recommending, you know, another biopsy. What do you think?
Well, that's a very, very good question. I have a lot of things in your answer there. You know, for one quick thing, I was going to comment on the seminoma. We were radiating most patients with seminoma in the past, even if they were stage one. We've shifted away from doing radiation to the retroperitoneal lymph nodes for seminoma, and most of them are doing observation nowadays. Now, in terms of the prostate cancer, you know, there's a couple of things that can be done to augment the PSA test. The free PSA sometimes is used. There's a few other.
I've done that. Yep.
Is it low or is it high? Do you know?
It was borderline.
Okay.
It was borderline.
A very low free PSA is suggestive of prostate cancer, but again, the biopsy is the only way to tell. And I was going to recommend, if you hadn't considered it, the MRI-directed biopsy, like you had just discussed. Now, you know, if it's a very, very small part of the prostate, and, you know, it's going to be your decision, obviously, about that. I think some people would want to know that we have some information from the biopsy that helps us predict the prognosis of the cancer. So what we have are the Gleason scores. You've probably heard about Gleason scores before.
Yes.
So Gleason scores range from a total number of 6 to a number of 10. And nowadays, they could. In the old days, they went to 5 or 4, but nowadays, realistically, we never see less than 6. 6 is a very favorable prostate cancer that one could easily sit on and watch and wait. 8, 9, 10 for a 63-year-old would be a high-risk cancer that would be a high risk to progress and spread to other sites. And I think that information from the biopsy, whether it's a Gleason 6, 7, 8, 9, or 10, would be potentially helpful for you.
I've had a couple of biopsies, you know, prostate biopsies. Yeah, it's a little bit of it hurts a little bit, but it's not so terrible, is it?
Well, I'm not convinced that the mass that is showing up in the MRI isn't just scarring from the two biopsies I've done. I don't know if I'm doing more damage than helping by being, you know, invasive things like biopsies. So I just don't, you know, I'm more interested in finding alternative, you know, natural things like yoga or meditation or or herbs or whatever than, you know, invading, you know, cutting things out.
Well, David, is our caller's worry about shadows caused by scarring, is that a legitimate worry?
We usually worry about if you have a biopsy and then you do the MRI right afterwards, there's always some bleeding. So we're always careful to wait at least 6 weeks after a biopsy before we would do an MRI. When they do an MRI, they usually do nowadays 12 cores, and so they kind of sample the entire prostate. If there's something that's very different from that, and usually you would expect most of the prior biopsies to have healed within probably a couple of months. So if your biopsies were in the distant past, I'd be surprised that the area they're talking about is actually related to the prior biopsies. I have a feeling it could be something worth checking out. But again, this is your body, and all we can do as physicians is to educate you as to what the possibilities are and whether to do it or not. With prostate cancer uniquely, there's such a variability of time course for progression, that I think a lot of patients do decide to watch and wait. But it really is more reassuring if you know that you have a very favorable Gleason score. If you had a Gleason 6, for instance, and you had a tiny little focus of prostate cancer, I think a lot of people would say this is very reasonable to just to watch and wait, just follow the PSAs and not do anything. And you'd not be worried that there's something down there that's going to potentially cause you problems.
Thanks a lot. 1-800-348-2551. So something strange is going on here. We have one of the world's greatest experts in this, or one of the great experts right here, who was Sloan Kettering for all of those years, knows his stuff basically, and we have nobody on the phone. So that could mean one of two things. Very strange, very strange. One, that the phone system is not working, parenthesis, again. Or that nobody is using the phones that do exist. Now, Zachary, our chief engineer on the board right now, is checking. I can see him dialing to see whether anything is ringing. I don't see anything ringing, which would mean it's time to bring our experts from the second floor in the cracked engineering department down here. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. I hate when that happens. Okay, so does coffee cause cancer in your area?
No, I don't know that there's been strong data supporting coffee as an agent for cancer in any type of cancer, to be honest. There was an initial study a long time ago looking at pancreas cancer as being caused by coffee, but we really don't know.
Do we have any idea what causes pancreas cancer?
No, there are some hereditary, risk factors. Some families will have risk for pancreas cancer. There's not a lot of data for anything other than advanced age. I think that's the common link for most cancers. As you age, your cells have to keep dividing. And you think about how many millions of cells that we have in our body. Each time a cell divides, the DNA from one cell has to be copied faithfully to the next cell, and that's a very, very complicated process. And there's always some changes as the DNA from one cell is copied to another cell. We have a lot of different proofreading enzymes that go back behind and check and make changes. But anytime one of those changes persists into the next cell, that's a mutation. And so as you live, you have more mutations, more chances for that to happen. So generally, it's age is the main contributor for most cancers.
That's fascinating. So I guess the next question is, what's new, Doc?
Well, I think the thing that's been exciting all of us oncologists for the last few years has been immunotherapy. And so back, when I was in New York City, we had some thoughts about immune therapy at the time. But the only things that really worked a little bit, there was for kidney cancer and melanoma. There was something called high-dose interleukin-2, very, very toxic treatment. We didn't even do it at Sloan Kettering. We thought it was really too toxic. But it did produce long-term survivals in a small number of patients with melanoma and kidney cancer. So that was some initial kind of rationale that maybe immune therapy is important. And most of the time I was there until about 2006, there really wasn't much still going on in immune therapy. People were thinking, well, the immune system's not that strong. Why, we have patients who have immunologic problems, and they don't have that many cancers. Most of the time, you don't really see a lot of cancers. But then several years ago, there were several new ways that we started to look at immune therapy, and they've given rise to a number of new drugs. So there are checkpoints, it turns out. There's a lot of processes as an immune system comes to recognize cancers. We know that in the cell, in the culture dish and in animals, that the immune system is capable of killing cancer cells. And so people were trying to figure out, why do cancers grow when somebody has an intact immune system?
1-800-348-2551. I'm told by our cracked engineering department that things are working once again. 1-800-348-2551. While we're waiting for those calls to come in, Well, I'm waiting for Ray Graff is helping me out right here. Look, they're
the
all.
Phones will be coming in a moment.
Thank you. Now get it.
Continue to bam.
Thank you. Now get out. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. On behalf of all of our providers, I do apologize. Go ahead. Did you want to say something?
Well, I'll just briefly say that immune therapy has been extremely interesting. We have new FDA-approved drugs for bladder cancer and kidney cancer. You may see some of the commercials on TV for lung cancer, but some of the same drugs are being used for bladder cancer, kidney cancer at this point.
Okay, we got a lot of people on the phones now. I'm not surprised. Let's go to Robert in Muncie. Okay, Robert, you're on. Go ahead. Robert.
Hello.
Go ahead.
Hi.
Hi.
Hey, I got a little question about heredity and prostate cancer. If my father, all of his brothers, and a couple of my uncles on my mother's side have all had prostate cancer. Every single one of them. About eight people.
What ages were they?
Ranging from... I can't remember exactly. I think my father was probably in his 60s and... around probably between 50 and 70 or something like that. I'm not exactly sure.
It does sound like you may have hereditary prostate cancer risk in the family for sure. I mean, there's several things that you can do. There's several things that you could.
Beg your pardon?
There's several things that you can do to try to. PSA testing is controversial. It's not as controversial if you have a strong family history. So PSA testing could be something that you could do on a regular basis. I don't know if you're doing that already.
Yeah, I am. But as I understand it is a little bit, it's not really definitive one way or the other.
Well, if the PSA test is very high, it tends to be very definitive. It's just that a lot of times when patients have no specific risk for prostate cancer and you get a borderline a PSA score, then you're not sure what to do. But somebody who has a strong family history and wants to be proactive, I think the PSA test could be useful.
Thank you very much. All right. Now we'll go to Marianne in Hyde Park. All right, Marianne, your turn. Go ahead, Marianne.
Hi. The question I had is I was just very, very recently diagnosed with interstitial cystitis, which was actually quite a relief because of, honest to God, like 6 years of pain that no one could seem to figure out what it was. And my question is this. I'm 60 years old, and I'm curious if this condition could lead towards bladder cancer.
Mm. I'm not really sure about that, Marianne.
Doesn't interstitial mean we don't know?
Well, no. Interstitial means it's kind of a property of the cells. There's inflammation. Cystitis, any itis, is an inflammation. So there's like chronic inflammation in the bladder. And in some cancers, we know that chronic inflammation can lead to cancers. I'm not really sure about chronic cystitis. This would be something probably the urologist, again, would be better. The people who probably worked you up before. I'm not familiar with that, though.
Thank you, Marianne.
Okay.
All right. Let's go to Ruth in Schoharie. Ruth in Schoharie, you're on. Your turn.
Hello. I have a question. My fiance is 57 years old, and we discovered last year that his bladder stopped working. He has to cath himself about 6 to 8 times a day, probably forever. He unfortunately is a smoker, but would the fact that his nerves and his bladder have died, would that cause a higher risk for bladder cancer? I know, I realize now listening that the smoking would do it, but
yeah,
the fact that, and would there be things to look for if that was happening?
Yeah, there is an increased risk. I think it usually happens over decades, but people who have had neurogenic bladder and have had to catheterize themselves, probably because of chronic inflammation, they do have a high risk of a squamous cancer of the bladder. And I think probably close follow-up with the urologist, it would be the most important thing to do. They'll check urine cytologies, things, checking urine abnormal for abnormal cells. That would probably be the most important thing to do.
Okay. Thank
and,
you.
And stop smoking if possible.
Yeah, I've been trying to get them to do that.
Okay.
Thanks,
Ruth. Thank you.
Bye. Okay, and we'll now go to Richard in Queensbury. All right, Richard, you're on.
Hi. I had a question. Are nitrates in processed meat and so on a source of cancer?
Yeah, I don't think we really know that for sure, unfortunately.
Well, I've been encountering these so-called uncured meats, and they have, like, celery as a substitute for nitrates, but it turns out that celery works because it's a natural source of nitrates, so I'm not sure it's really working, you know, does any good.
I don't really have any data about nitrates in cancer, unfortunately. I think the people have speculated that, though, for sure.
Thank you, Richard. Appreciate it.
All right.
Yep, bye. And now we'll go to Donna. No, now we'll take a break, and then we'll go to Donna.
Support comes from Vassar Brothers Medical Center, now specializing in Makoplasty partial knee surfacing as an option to total knee replacement for early to mid-stage osteoarthritis. HealthQuest.org/ortho. United Way of the Greater Capital Region, working to combat local issues like hunger, domestic violence, and kids in crisis. Donations stay local, help local. UnitedToConquer.org. The Brattleboro Retreat, providing hospital-based mental health services, including medically assisted alcohol withdrawal. BrattleboroRetreat.org for information. Empire State English, now issuing the I-20 form and welcoming full-time students and professionals from around the world to their intensive English programs in Albany and Saratoga Springs, New York, esenglish.org. And from Sage Wine and Spirits, Boston Spa, New York, providing worldwide sustainable and organic wines and spirits, offering weekly tastings, sagewinespirits.com.
And we are back. We are back with our very good friend, Dr. David Schaefer of New York Oncology Hematology, doing a great job, David. Thank you so much for doing that. We'll go to Donna now, as promised. All right, Donna, you're on.
Hi. Thank you so much for Medical Mondays. They're always very informative. And to get out of the way, I'm not a smoker, never was. My question is more about breast cancer, preventing breast cancer, et cetera. My mother has had several surgeries for fibrous tumors. My mother's sister had breast tumors, which ultimately caused lung cancer, and she has passed away. I've always had large, dense breasts, which were hard to read. So when I get my mammograms, they frequently follow up with an ultrasound. So I've added a lot of vitamin E into my diet. I've eliminated red meat. I would say I have red meat maybe every other week. Once every other week. And I'd like to know, you know, what is the propensity for the breast cancer to follow through on the family line, and what else I might do to help minimize the chances of my having breast cancer. I'm 71. My aunt developed her breast cancer at 71.
Mm. Well, Donna, it seems like you're doing everything that you could potentially do at this point, and I don't think we have strong data enough to, for me as a physician, to advise you about diet for most kind of cancers, including breast cancer. But I think the follow-up with the mammograms and ultrasounds as needed is probably the most important thing you can do.
What about the BRCA gene?
Yeah, if you have not already been tested, it's a good point, Alan. I think if your family has not already been tested for, they have a variety of different tests out there now. It used to be only BRCA 2, BRCA 1. Mm-hmm. There are other new kind of combination gene testing sets that can be done. There's genetic counselors in our offices and many other offices where you can go and really be tested. They'll take a very, very good family history, and they'll test, depending on how strong the family history is, they will test for BRCA1, BRCA2, and they'll test for other genes that may be related for your family. I think that's a good point.
So I go to an oncologist's office to get that type of testing done?
Yeah, that's usually where we have, I know in our practice, we have several certified genetic counselors that can kind of give you more information. And it used to be you'd have to do a very expensive sequencing for BRCA1, BRCA2, and you'd only get information on that one or two genes. But nowadays there's new panels that would test for multiple different genes that might be involved.
All right, and one last question. What about the value of vitamin E? I heard that many years ago, and I took that action, but has there been any recent studies? Is there anything that supports the use of vitamin E to help?
I wish there was. I'm not aware of any vitamins so far that have been proven in large clinical trials to really prevent cancer. I'm more familiar, as we mentioned before, with prostate, bladder, kidney tests. For vitamin E, it was actually thought for a while that vitamin E and selenium were important for prostate cancer. So they did a study. They had many thousands of men randomized to get either vitamin E or selenium, and neither one was protective. So
that's when I stopped.
Yeah, right. So it was a very famous study, and most of the vitamins, when they've been tested like that, it may be we're not doing it in the right way, but I mean, vitamin D for prostate cancer, that was a big thing for a while. When I was at Sloan Kettering, my boss there was in charge of a large study where they were giving patients very, very high dose of vitamin D plus chemotherapy Taxotere and versus Taxotere alone, because the preliminary data for vitamin D looked very good and up to phase 2 studies, but then the phase 3 study broke down and they did not see any advantage at all. And so the company that was making that went out of business.
I still take it.
Okay.
Thanks a lot.
I think a small amount
so
is probably
very
useful.
Much.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
But
well,
high doses is the problem. Yeah. I think low doses, we up in the North Country, we may not get enough vitamin D. So I think a low dose of vitamin D is very reasonable.
Gotcha. Okay, so now I have to look for who we go to next. Oh, yeah. All right, that would be Glenn on line number 7. Okay, Glenn, you're on.
Hey, thank you. I have a question about the PSA test. I had a 3.6. Or next 6 months, I went to a 3.9, and then the follow-up was 4.8. Mm. So they wanted to do a biopsy.
Yeah.
But I had that 4K score test done, and that came back with, I think you referred to it as a Gleason 6. And basically, it said I don't have anything to be concerned about, at least for 10 years.
Okay.
Is that the...
Well, I'm not sure exactly right. If you had a prostate biopsy and you had Gleason 6 tumor...
No biopsy.
Oh, no biopsies, okay.
4K score.
I'm not sure about the...
4K score.
I'm not sure what the 4K score is, to be honest. That may be a urology test.
It's a new blood test, sort
of. Oh, okay. Maybe it's probably
Memorial
the
Sloan was involved.
Okay,
in
probably the kallikreins, probably. Okay, so I understand what you're talking about. Probably there are several different blood tests. I'm not sure yet whether what that shows, but we're certainly looking for better markers than just PSA alone. So there's a kallikreins, which is a form of, it's very similar to PSA. And they're trying to combine various different tumor markers together to get a better marker of what can distinguish benign prostatic disease versus cancer. So I don't use that. I really see mostly prostate cancer patients who have already been diagnosed for some time. So I'm not as much involved as a urologist in the initial diagnosis of prostate cancer. But it sounds like you're getting good management.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks.
Okay. So now, looking at my magic board here, we'll go to, number 10. All right, number 10 is Steve in Saratoga. Go.
Hey, thank you. I'm 58-year-old, never smoked, had kidney cancer about 5 years ago, had one kidney removed. During the surgery, they tested the tissues and didn't find that the cells had moved. And so I've had no other treatments other than the removal of the kidney. And I get periodic CAT scans looking for tumors to pop up? And what are, just think the chances are that this could repeat itself somewhere?
Well, there's a couple of things I don't know from your history. One of them would be the Furman grade. It's just like kind of like the PSA. It shows you how aggressive the tumor looked under the microscope. But secondly, the size of the tumor. You're 5 years out now, is that what you said?
Yeah, it was a 6.5-centimeter tumor.
I mean, I think the chance of you being cured is pretty high, most likely. And we don't still have any what they call adjuvant therapy for kidney cancer. We've been adjuvant therapy means an additional treatment that could be given to reduce the chance of recurrence after you've had surgery and when the scans are all negative. We have adjuvant therapies for breast cancer and colon cancer and lung cancer and ovarian cancer. And we have clinical trials that are ongoing looking at adjuvant therapy for kidney cancer, but there's still nothing yet in standard of care that could be given. So,
now, what's adjuvant mean?
So adjuvant means help. Adjuvant is a help, and what it means, you're helping the surgeon to cure more patients by giving it. It's in breast cancer, it's typically chemotherapy, sometimes hormonal therapy, depending on the characteristics of the tumor. In colon cancer, it's chemotherapy. So let's just say for colon cancer, you basically would be giving chemotherapy for 6 months after the surgery's done if you had lymph node that are taken out but that had high risk for that had cancer in those lymph nodes. And the reason why is that even though all of the gross visible disease has been removed, the fact that the tumor had the mutations that allow it to spread to those lymph nodes makes it a higher risk, that it could have gone further on to other places. And so that's the same thing in breast cancer. If the tumor has gone to those lymph nodes, or even a large size tumor makes it high risk to recur. So what we're doing with adjuvant therapy is trying to eliminate any microscopic foci of disease that could be out there that are not showing up on the scans yet.
Mm. Okay. Anything else?
No, that's good. Thank you.
Thanks a lot. All right, now we're going to go to line number one. Matt. Hey, Matt, you're on. Go ahead.
Hi, how are you doing, doctor? My father has stage 4 renal cell cancer. It's already metastasized to his bones in the iliac as well as in the clavicle. And I'm trying to find out. He's taking Votrient right now, but he's having a lot of side effect problems with it. And he has a complicated medical history in addition to that. Can you give me any ideas to what other treatments are around out there for an advanced stage like that?
Yeah, we're lucky now in kidney cancer. That's one of those that we had very little treatment, very few treatments for, you know, maybe 15 years ago. Since 2005, there have been 10 new drugs that have been FDA approved for treatment of metastatic kidney cancer. So there's about 6 drugs that are approved that are very similar to Votrient. And so you can switch over. There's a lot of drugs. There's Inlyta, also called Axitinib. There's Sunitinib or Sutent. A lot of them, if you think he could be benefiting, so one of the things we also do is reduce the dose sometimes. So if he's on the usual dose, which is 800 milligrams a day, we may switch down to 600 milligrams a day.
They did that, yeah.
Okay, and some patients will do better in terms of their side effects. It's also a matter of really close follow-up. I'm sure his oncologist is doing that, but you have to follow up all the side effects, which can include like things like diarrhea. Sometimes there's blisters on the hands and feet, blood pressure, those sorts of things. You can often address all those things individually. But there are many other treatments out there. There's new immune therapy out there. There's the nivolumab Opdivo out there after he's had Votrient for a while. But like I said, 10 new drugs and new clinical trials out there all the time right now.
Okay, thank you very much. All right. Now I'm looking at the magic thing here, and it says to go to Tracy on line number 6. Tracy, you're on.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call. So I want to say just, first of all, a shout-out to New York Oncology, because I've had 3 friends that have had wonderful care through that practice. So thank you very much for that. So my 2 questions are this. I understand that, you know, if you start out with breast cancer and it metastasizes, it is always breast cancer. Mm-hmm. But my question is, you know, if you are a specialist in breast cancer and the cancer metastasizes to the bone or to the pancreas or to the lungs or, you know, just any of the other places, like I'm a little confused about how that one oncologist knows how to treat so many different areas of the body, and I'm assuming the answer is breast cancer is breast cancer is breast cancer, no matter
where it
is.
You got it. That's exactly right. So the biology of the disease, it started as a abnormal cell in the breast. It develops new mutations, and there's new mutations that arise as the tumor begins to spread to other places. But it's still essentially a breast cancer, no matter where it's trying to reside. So generally, it will be treated the same way. So we all have, we're all trained in internal medicine, so we all know a little bit about the lungs and the liver and those sorts of things. But you really treat a breast cancer when it's metastasized like a breast cancer.
Okay, and then my next question, which is what none of us ever really want to ask, but how come some, and I understand about the fact that cancer is metastasized and people get to stage four and this and that, but how come some cancers when they present, you know, by the time you're diagnosed and stuff, some they're like, yep, we can clear this right out and get you in remission, and then it seems like more and more often cancers are sort of becoming a maintenance disease where there's not the hope that you'll be cured, but with all the therapies you've actually been talking about, you know, it certainly extends life. Mm-hmm. But how come some cancers just cannot be cured?
Well, most cancers, if they've spread, most of the solid tumors that we treat can't be cured. The big exception is testis cancer. Testis cancer is the one cancer that, for reasons of the biology of that disease, we don't quite understand, can be cured even if it's widely spread by four cycles of chemotherapy. Most other cancers, if they've spread widely enough that we can see them on the scans, aren't curable. There's, again, rare exceptions, but most of the time that's not the case. And why that's the case, why they can't be cured, it's difficult. I mean, we can, with some of our most effective treatments, we can whittle down the tumor from, you know, maybe even to 95% of what, get rid of 95% of the bad cells with really effective treatments, but then that core of resistant cells still seem to be there. And in terms of why some patients present like that, it's, you know, sometimes a matter of just how long before they, you know, look for cell symptoms that could have been there along. And some people will look for those symptoms very quickly. Some people take a long time.
I got to go. Thank you, Fred. Thanks a lot. Let's go very quickly to Dick in Long Meadow. We're running out of time. Dick, be quick. Go ahead.
Yes. Really make it quick. I'm just wondering if you see any new studies in some of these new drugs called immuno-oncology. Merck has one, and I think Bristol-Myers has one. That's the one they gave to Jimmy Carter for his problem, and it worked. And do you see any usage for immuno-oncology products in your specialty?
Yes, we do. We right now we're very active in atezolizumab has already been approved. It's a drug from Genentech, also called Tecentriq, has been approved in second-line treatment of bladder cancer, and nivolumab, also called Opdivo, has been approved as second-line treatment in kidney cancer.
And very expensive, yes?
Yeah, they're expensive, but a lot of benefits, and most patients don't have many side effects with them as much as they would with other treatments, and sometimes the responses can be very durable.
Cool. Okay, let's go now to Bryce. All right, Bryce, it's your turn. You got to be real quick. We're out of time. Go ahead.
All right. So I have a question about a ketogenic diet when you have cancer, and if that could kind of starve the cancer cells of sugar.
You know,
they need to reproduce.
Yeah, we really don't know much about those sorts of diets. You know, to be honest, a lot of those studies were done in cell cultures and things like that, the studies that provide rationale, and those are conditions we can't really replicate in a human body. We have so many homeostatic mechanisms in our body to try to keep our pH at the right amount and our sugars at the right amount. So when you try to do that, it just usually doesn't work.
Okay, that's your answer, and we'll go to Tim. And boy, Tim, you've got to really be quickly. Go ahead, quick. Go ahead, Tim.
Is this Tim in Saratoga?
Yeah, go ahead, Tim.
I'll be as quick as I can. I'm 64 years old. I was diagnosed in 2008 with prostate cancer. I'm now 72. My PSA was low, 3.75. My doctor heard that. I told my doctor my brother had prostate cancer a year ago. He said I have the brother factor. He recommended a biopsy. The biopsy, he called me and said, I really didn't think you had it, but you have a heavy case of it. I had a PS, I had a Gleason of 7.0 and a 35% chance of spread. I had external radiation, beam radiation first.
Okay, there's got to be a question. Hey, come on. There's got to be a question.
A question. All right. I have had the seed implant, and I'm 8 years out. Do you know anything about the statistics after, say, 8 to 10 years?
I mean, I think you're doing very well. 8 to 10 years, most people are going to do well if you haven't had any clinical recurrence by then.
Okay, thank you very much. We are out of time. I'm so sorry, everybody. And David Schaefer, you're welcome back here anytime. Dr. David Schaefer of New York Oncology Hematology, where he is the principal investigator for all research trials involving those types of cancers. As also clinical assistant professor at Albany Medical College, board-certified medical oncologist. And thank you, David, for doing this with us. And in any case, let me just say a few things, which are, we apologize to David and Nancy and T. Marie because we couldn't get to their questions. We're out of time. And I want to thank you again, David, for your being with us today. Support for medical oncology comes from New York Oncology and Hematology. New York Oncology Hematology for over 30 years, providing comprehensive treatment of cancer and blood disorders. World-class care close to home, newyorkoncology.com. Thanks to our engineer, the incredible Zach Malloy. Thanks to Joe Makowitz for answering the phones and keeping me honest. Our producer is Jim Lavoulis, and I'm Alan Chartok. Thanks again for joining us on the Vox Pop. Remember, the conversation continues online at wamc.org/VoxPop. And you can stay tuned now for a news update and a little bit of theme supplied by our own Zach Malloy.